Access number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about the cold weather, you know, the back end of the year, 1952. How did you try and counter the cold? I mean, you know, it was very cold. What was your, how adequate was your uniform, or did you have extra clothes?
We had the standard issue, cold, wet weather issue that was available at that time. Was a string vest, a conventional army shirt, a thick pullover with a drawstring neck, a windproof, reasonably waterproof combat jacket, and on top of that, a parka with a fur hood, fur collar, and with a wire visor, which meant you could just peer out with your eyes and your mouth and those were covered. On the bottom half of your body you had long johns, a pair of inner fleece lined trousers, a pair of combat trousers with puttees, and then on your feet you had heavy boots with a special nylon insole. They were called cold wet boots. And thick socks, but even then you were still cold, to be honest. And you had good mitts for your hands.
Now, what about heating in the bunkers or what?
We had what we call chuff boxes, and they were fires that we made from metal ammunition boxes. The lid would be cut in half. In one half you'd make a chimney from shell cases or from ammunition. Mortar bombs used to come in cases and they could make a reasonable chimney out of those. You then had a drip feed of diesel into the bottom of the ammunition box, which is noted. And you then dripped until once it lit, you just drip fed diesel in, which kept it going. And it used to get quite hot, so we kept reasonably warm with them. But virtually everybody in the bunker had what we termed called a chuff box, which is how we kept warm.
Now, what do you remember much about what happened to you that winter? I mean, as far as you were concerned, any events?
Well, in November 52. I was standing out by the command post where the signals, all the signals equipment was, and a mortar went off. There is a belief, and it was never proved whether it was incoming mortar or whether it was, because our platoon were firing at the time, there was a possibility it was one of ours that had come out and had got sort of just airborne and then exploded. But I was exposed and got hit with about 9 pieces of shrapnel. There was a couple of young...
So that's after you'd been there about 3 months?
Yeah. There's a couple of small Korean houseboys. They weren't supposed to be with military in the line, but they were 14, 13, 14 year olds. And they got hurt at the same time. I was patched up by the medic.
Now, how
attached.
Bad were your wounds? I mean, it sounds they're dreadful. 9 bits of shrapnel.
Well, I got one piece of shrapnel went through the upper left muscle, came out the back.
Left arm.
Through there and out the back. The piece hit me in the skull, which I must be hard-headed because it skidded around my head and finished up in the back. I had my right arm, my elbow was damaged. I had several bits of shrapnels in my legs, my ankle. So it was sort of spread around my body. I lost a fair bit of blood, obviously. It was painful. well, it was unusual. I mean, it was just like a hot blast and then followed by a series of painful sort of spots in the body, but I was shipped fairly quickly via a stretcher on a Bren gun carrier through the camouflage Road to, I think it was a Canadian field dressing station where they first sort of sorted the wounds out. And then I was shipped by a military ambulance to the Norwegian MASH, Norwegian Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, which was similar to the MASH you see on television, a large tented compound with medical staff, but they were Norwegians.
Now, how were you treated there?
Very well. I had every stitch of clothing was cut off, and I was left lying on a table in a birthday suit like the day I was born, covered with a blanket. It was cold, being November. After a couple of 3 minutes, a tall Norwegian statuesque blonde nurse walked in to give me some x-rays, and it was the first real white woman of any attraction that I'd seen for several months. She's a very attractive lady. But I was x-rayed, and I then was put under, when they removed the shrapnel, in which they stuck in a bottle if I wanted to keep it, which I had no great desire to keep. And I was there for 3.5 weeks, I think it was, while I was recuperating. And then I was had to make my own way back to the battalion.
So you weren't sent home with wounds? They were regarded as not serious?
Well, my mother received a telegram from the War Office, which I haven't got the copy, and what happened to it, I don't know, but I did see it when I came back home. It just said from the War Office, regret to inform you that your son, Malcolm William David Frost, who's here, da-da-da-da-da, has been wounded in action, wounds of moderate severity. We will advise you later. But they never did. My mum was left in limbo until I got somebody to write a letter for me, because my right arm became quite immobile for a time with this problem with the elbow. I got somebody to write a letter to my parents fairly quickly, which allayed the fear that made sure that I knew that they knew I was okay. But the War Office never followed up that initial telegram. And it was quite a shock to them, I think, because having lost my brother not that long previously, when he dropped dead playing football, they were quite worried about it. But I was well trained, but the only good feature about getting wounded was that you automatically got every kit deficiency made up. If you'd lost things prior to being wounded, that didn't sort of matter. What happened was that when you got back to unit, quartermaster went through your kit, and anything you hadn't got was replaced without question.
And that was in what, December?
That was,
was it
the end of November.
The end of November?
Yeah, because I think it was the 2nd of November, I think, when I got wounded. And it was the end of November. We were still in the line, actually.
Where they were when you left them?
Mm.
And how did you feel about having to go back to you? I mean, did you hope you'd be sent home, or were you not bothered?
No, I wasn't bothered. I'd made a sort of complete recovery. I was completely mobile. And I went back to unit.
Even your arm?
Yeah. It was... The shrapnel actually locked my elbow joint, which once it had been removed, it gradually sort of healed up, so that soon got okay. But for the first few days, it was immobile. But I was just thinking, I wounded in the beginning of November, but Christmas we were still in the front line, so there was we must have had a longer stint than 6 weeks.
Now, anything before line. Christmas, or is Christmas the next thing you remember?
I think really going back to unit, end of November, early December, Really, Christmas was the next sort of thing I remembered.
And did they make an effort? I mean, you were a long way from home, but did they make an effort?
Yeah. Something that was all stick in my mind. We had a colour sergeant, Tiddler Finch, he was known by. I've never met anybody as tattooed before or since in my life, but he had a heart of gold. He was a real old sweat. And I don't know whether you've ever come across water purification tablets, but they come in a small tin box in two small bottles. And there's tablets which you use to purify the water. I remember on Christmas Day, we were in the line, and Tiddler Finch came up in the 1500 weight truck. And somehow, and I don't know how he did it, he had managed to hold back or somehow produce an item of mail, at least one item of mail, for every soldier in the platoon. He gave each of us one of these little tins of water purification tablets, which he'd emptied out the chemicals, had cleaned them up, and filled both little bottles with rum, which to me was quite a nice touch. But we were out of the line almost immediately after Christmas, so...
Was there any special food for Christmas?
No, we just had the standard Christmas. Christmas was going to be celebrated, we were told, when we came out of the line and went to reserve, which is actually what happened.
Well, what did they do for you there?
We came out of the line just after the New Year, I think about the 3rd or the 4th of January. It was traditional on Christmas Day that the officers served gunfire or early morning tea to soldiers, which they did while we were in Camp Casey. So it's Camp Casey we went back to. And we did then have a reasonable sort of Christmas, an attempt to have some sort of jollification for Christmas. We had a company get together and a bit of a party with a few beers and a bit of entertainment from the various squaddies.
What sort of thing?
Well, I told a few Norfolk jokes, and we had one or two people singing the usual bawdy army songs. Gents and generals all get together and a bit of an ease up, to be honest. That was quite amusing. That was not long after that when we had the episode of when I set fire to the tent.
Now tell me what happened there. That's in reserve then.
We're in reserve. It was a tented area, and obviously fire was a considerable risk. Each of the large tents, we were in sort of large military style tents with about 8, 10 beds down each side. They had a big stove in the middle, which was again a diesel fed stove, and the diesel was held in the inverted jerry cans outside. Well, one day in during the month of January, the intelligence officer had fire had broken out, and his tent had been burnt out to the ground with all his belongings and a lot. And a strong sort of order had gone round the site that fire risk was high, and therefore we had to be extra vigilant and not to start a fire. Well, in the middle of one evening, the diesel supply to the stove in the tent where I was with some of the other Signals Platoon members had run out. So I, in my usual way, as always the helpful, friendly sort I was, said I'd go out and replenish the supply, because we always had a spare can standing outside ready. So myself and another signaller, who I've since kept in touch with, I still get in touch with Les, we went out to replenish the diesel. But it was pitch black, couldn't really see what was happening. So I said to Les, well, have you got your lighter? And he said yes, because diesel doesn't ignite very quickly, as you probably appreciate, not in cold temperatures. It takes a bit of getting going. So he struck his lighter while I inverted the can of fresh diesel, but unbeknown to both of us, somebody had actually put a can of petrol there. And immediately the lot went up flames. I was a fusilier at the time, and the Lance Corporal came dashing from the tent, a Yorkshire bully who was an absolute prat, if you'll pardon the expression, who decided the way to put the fire was to throw a bucket of sand at her, which did nothing more than sort of spread it everywhere. And the side of the guy ropes caught fire, and the fire bell went, and the fire was eventually extinguished. But myself and Les were put on SEALS orders as a result. I sound a bit daft, but when you answer those orders, you had somebody represent you, usually an officer if you wished. And we had an adjutant who was quite, rather as regarded, was quite gullible. And I explained to him that it was a proven scientific fact that if you poured a flammable substance onto metal, which was sub-zero temperatures, that you could get instantaneous combustion. And he believed it. And so when I on SEALS orders, he put forward the defence that it had been caused by a flammable substance being instantaneous combustor by making. The SEAL just looked at him and said, "Don't talk such bloody nonsense. 14 days confined in the barracks for both of us." So Captain Montagu Brown was not amused that he'd been conned. So we got 14 days Jankers.
And what was that? Tell us about that.
Jankers was, you could have all sorts. It was keeping the camp clean, going around, litter picking, doing whatever. But I got cookhouse duties. And I've never seen such enormous greasy pans to wash in sort of scalding hot water in my life. But I was very lucky because I'd been doing about 4 days, I think, and they decided that they would put on a battalion concert. And
now, hang on, before we got the concert, how did you actually get these dirty great things clean? I mean,
well, you had
hot water,
sort of a washing up liquid type with damn great stiff brushes, which you scrub the grease off with. You got them reasonably clean, but they were mainly the large serving dishes that when the cooks had cooked. I mean, they put these enormous metal trays out with the spuds and all the other things in when they served out, and that was really what they were, and the cooking utensils as well. But you just had hot water, a bit of sort of soap or soap type liquid, and a lot of scrubbing involved with hard big old stiff brushes. But I say they decided they were going to put on a company, a battalion concert, and the two NCOs who were charged with producing it were in fact both support company sergeants, Sergeant Pilbeam, I can't remember the other one. Well, they'd remembered me telling a few Norfolk stories at the Christmas gathering, and they wanted me to do a turn in the concert. So they said, "We want you to come and rehearse." And I said, "Well, I can't because I'm on Jankers." So they said, "Well, don't worry about that. We'll get you off." So I thought, yeah, I've heard that before. But they did, much to the chagrin of the RP sergeant, who's a little Yorkshireman called Titch Grantham, who stood 5 foot nothing in his socks. He was the nastiest individual you could ever wish to meet. And he was most incensed that he lost one of his Janker wallers, as he called them, because he's gone to this bloody airy fairy concert. But I actually got off about 10 days of my Jankers by participating in the battalion concert.
Now, what? Tell me about that concert party. How was it organised? What was the rehearsal? What was the show?
It was made up of a variety of acts. It was set up in an enormous marquee, one, the big cookhouse building. They made an improvised stage with a curtain. They actually had a band from, I think it was sort of a dance band from the 2nd or 3rd Royal Australian Rifles. I can't remember which it came from. Though I also remember somebody sticks in my mind. He was an Aussie, and he did an Al Jolson impression, and he was absolutely brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So it was some musical items, singing, bit of storytelling, and that was it really. I remember all the CEO and the officers sat in the front row. I did my bit, told a few stories, told one or two stories against the hierarchy in the army, and then we all had to do a music hall song at the end. All the participants had a little slot when you had to. We actually sang one of the old music hall songs. I did Henry VIII, sang that, and so that was it. But it was interesting that about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, there was a young squaddy from in Norfolk from Sandham Down and out towards Thetford Forestry Commission way. And he was missing, believed, killed. And in fact, he was never, ever found. They thought he might have been taken prisoner, but he wasn't. He was never, body was never recovered, and Johnny Snare was never found. And about 7 years ago, his sisters eventually got the local church. They wouldn't put his name on the war memorial, but actually they put a plaque up in Sandham Downham Church. And I went over with several of the other ex-Korean vets. And the padre from the 1st Battalion came to do the service. A chap called Freddie Preston, he's since died. And so it was, 40 plus years from the time I was in the force, and he still remembered the story I told him about the pig sitting in the wheelbarrow, which I thought must have made quite an impression. He remembered it. Oh yes, Frost, I remember you, the one who told the story about the pig sitting in the wheelbarrow, he said. So that's right, sir. But he was a fantastic padre, he really was.
Well, tell me a bit about him.
He used to come in and he used to provide communion in the line for us. So he would come up on any Sunday that he could. He obviously had various places to call within the battalion, so he didn't come to the platoons that often, but if he came to the platoon, he would always bring communion materials and
C of E
service and hold communion if we wanted it.
Was that important for you to get that?
To me it was. I'm not a devout Christian, but I'm a Christian. I've been confirmed Christian. I don't go to church, but I believe Christianity is not all about going to church. So to me it was important, yeah. And I had a wonderful rapport with him. He was a great character.
In what way? Tell us a bit about him. What type of a bloke was he, or padre?
He was one of the most down-to-earth. He was a captain, because padres are captains. But he was one of the most down-to-earth and wonderful characters you'd ever wish to meet. He was the sort of individual that you would have been proud to have as a friend in civvy life, don't mind the army. And he treated everybody in the same way. It didn't matter whether you were a squaddy or whether you were the CO, you were treated exactly the same way. Freddie Preston was an unusual individual to me. When he came out of the army, he had a parish in the heart of London somewhere, in a rundown part of London, and I believe he made quite an incredible sort of impression when he was there. He was quite a character, was Freddie Preston.
Any other characters you want to talk about, good or bad, while we're on one or two, you know? What about these NCOs? What were the NCOs like? How did you get on with them generally? We've talked a bit about them, but...
Yeah, we did, yeah. Got on extremely well, really, with most of them. One of the time myself kept in touch with, even to this day. We had one or two sergeants who were not that sort of, what I would call, pleasant to the lower ranks. They pulled through the weight around a bit. They were quite anxious to be looked after. I mean, the thing was, there was except when you're in reserve, there was no sergeant's mess, obviously. There was no officer's mess, unless you're in reserve. When you went in reserve, there was a sergeant's mess, there was a officer's mess. In fact, we also had a small corporal's mess where you could go and sit and have a beer. But when you're in the line, obviously, they wanted to be a bit pampered, looked after. And so they weren't always as pleasant as they could be, perhaps. But in the main, the NCOs were quite reasonable.
What about the officers?
I got on extremely well with the three officers that I was closely involved with. Two of them were commanders of the 3-inch mortar platoon. First one was Captain Walterkind, who was always a bit aloof, but I got on quite well with him because night times you were sitting in the command post with him, and basically you had to get on with him, otherwise life would have been pretty intolerable. He was replaced by somebody called Captain Mike Wheaton. Now, I got on extremely well with him. He used to have the telegraph sent to him regularly by sea mail. We got it late, but I always used to sit with him and do the crossword if I was on nights with him, while I was sitting in the quiet of the night where there's not much happening. So I used to sit with him and do the telegraph crossword, and Mike Wheaton I got on with extremely well. The other officer that I got on with well was Captain French, and I've met him again quite recently. He, without me knowing, he had a Norfolk connection. His family came from out here at Cossey near Norwich, and but Captain French was a very pleasant individual, and I got on extremely well with Maurice French. And he was, by then I was a corporal, but he was very pleasant.
Now, when were you made corporal?
Well, that was the sort of strange scene, because I was given my first stripe not long after I had my Jankers.
So you made Lance Corporal?
I made Lance Corporal, yeah.
What difference did it make when you were made Lance Corporal?
Not a lot, as far as I was concerned. I got a few bob on the pay packet. I meant there was one or two extra duties that you got involved with.
Such as?
Well, you were put in charge of tents and things like that, and put in charge of small work parties, and doing a bit of drilling if you had to, just keeping a bit of discipline. But I basically, as a Lance Corporal, I didn't feel I was anything other than one of the lads. I think when you got second stripe, it became a little bit different. You had to become a little bit remote and aloof if you were going to maintain discipline.
In what way?
Well, you had to be prepared to give orders and for those orders to be carried out. And you were given orders perhaps to your mates who had been mates with you previously, and who might have, if they wanted to, could have made life a bit difficult for you. So you had to be prepared to maintain a reasonable level of discipline without being heavy-handed. I did, on one or two occasions, have to sort of pull rank and sort people out. But that was very rare indeed.
Did most of them cooperate?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.